Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2006. And now, my pleasure to introduce tonight's guests. Harvey Pekar is a legend of underground comics. He's best known for his autobiographical slice of life comic book series, American Splendor, a first-person account of his everyday life in his hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. And I'm sure many of you have seen the wonderful movie of the same name in which Harvey is played both by an actor and by himself. Pekar's work, quote, goes beyond documenting a life into reflecting the art, reflecting the life, reflecting the art, says Four Walls, Eight Windows publisher John Oakes, who put out two American Splendor collections as well as the graphic novel Our Cancer Year. American Splendor is illustrated by high-profile artists such as Robert Crumb, Frank Stack, and Joe Sacco. In 1987, Pekar was honored with the American Book Award for the series. As Ed Park in The Village Voice wrote, Harvey Pekar is or has been a file clerk at the Cleveland VA Hospital, a juvenile delinquent, college dropout and failed Army recruit, a jazz aficionado, critic and record hustler, a Rust Belt anthropologist and antisocial shut-in, a driven, compulsive, mad Jew, as friend and frequent collaborator R. Crumb calls him, an expansive talker, a cantankerous guest on Letterman, a book reviewer of Zero Pretense and Maximum Stamina, a cancer survivor, a husband three times over, a guardian of a teenage girl, a loser, a mensch. It's quite a quote. His most recent books are American Splendor, Our Movie Year, The Quitter, and Ego and Hubris, The Mike Malice Story, which is about a New York native and fairly streetwise geek of frightening intelligence, if he does say so himself, which he does. And those books are for sale in our lobby, some of them. In 2001, Harvey retired from his job as a full-time file clerk at the local VA hospital, where he had worked since 1966, and we're very lucky to have lured him here to Los Angeles for this evening's program with Robbie. Robbie Canal grew up as a self-described art brat in New York City. He notes in his bio how he and his friends got kicked out of every major museum and every public library in town. He got psychedelicized at San Francisco State University in the 60s and professionalized, as he says, at Stanford in the 70s. And in the 80s, he brought his art and his social concerns together and began making pictures about politics, power, and the abuses of both. He made posters of his paintings, and with the help of his volunteer guerrilla postering army, some of whom might even be in the audience tonight, they went up all over town, and you've probably seen them, the men with no lips or the four smiling faces of Nancy Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Jean Kirkpatrick, and Joan Rivers with the boldly printed title, Women with Teeth, leering at you on your way to work in the morning.
They're too young.
Sorry. Well, some of them, not all.
They look young.
He has made more than 50 posters satirizing politicians from both parties, televangelists, and global capitalists. So we'll begin tonight. I'm going to kind of be the moderator, and we'll start from there.
Sue, welcome, welcome.
The only moderate voice in the house.
So I think we're going to start out with both of you giving a short little talk about your work, and we tossed coins, and Robbie goes first.
Okay.
Of course, you already said everything about it, but
yeah, I'm sure you can add a few other things, Rob. I'm sure.
I'll tell you anything. Louise, it's the drugs. The truth serum, I mean. I don't know. I grew up in New York City and on the upper left side of Manhattan. Both my parents were union organizers, labor union organizers. Yes! Save the world for the people who, working people or people who are looking to work from, I don't know, something they charmingly called global capitalist greed. I don't know how well they did, but it's a noble effort. And the thing is that I didn't see them very much because they were busy saving the world from capitalist greed. So I was kind of a latchkey kid, and they would just say, go to any museum you want and come back when the museum closes. And I don't know, I've told some of you that on weekends I would just wake up and they weren't around, but I would go to the refrigerator, open it, and there'd be a paper bag, brown paper bag with a peanut butter jelly sandwich, an apple, one Oreo cookie. What do you do with one Oreo cookie, Harvey? What do you do with one Oreo cookie? Cherish it.
I hear the sound of the Oreo cookie clapping.
Yeah. See, I need a writer. And what else was in there besides this clapping Oreo cookie? A dollar bill and two Subway tokens and a note, you know. Robala. Go to any museum you want. Come back when it's closed or go to another one. Love and solidarity, Mom and Dad. So I learned a lot about art just because, you know, Guernica was my pal. And I got my politics with my mother's breast milk, which was pink and delicious. And you, I don't know, I didn't even know I was learning all that stuff, but when it came around to, we're talking about like what motivates you, Harvey has this great line about things that you can count on, you know, like looking in the mirror and there's a disappointment that you can count on.
A reliable
disappointment, to quote him accurately. Thank you. And, you know, that's the way I feel about the government. When I wake up in the morning and read the paper, I mean, I read the paper, go, and run into the studio and do something nasty.
Hey, Robbie, do you want to show us? I mean...
Oh, yeah,
do you
sure.
want to show us your...
Sure. Can we do this?
Yes, we can do this.
Then
we'll go into the more free-flowing conversation.
I made some images. I took some shots of Harvey's stuff, but Harvey doesn't need... He's just going to talk. Oh, God, help me. Okay, so...
Can you bring the lights down? The house lights down, Gordon?
I was a little upset about Katrina. And more upset than W was. But we were working on a Dick Cheney poster for months and months. And just about to put it up when Katrina hit. And so, can't put that up. But we got to go do something about our inactive patriot. And... So we just happened to make the most complicated poster I've ever made faster than we ever made one before. And that's the way it goes. Just put it up all over the place. W, drowning in a flooded cemetery in New Orleans. Skeleton. It was around Halloween. Get the next one? Yeah. So this is before the 2004 election. This is what I love about young people and why I'm hopeful. You know, like, you can't do what I do or what Harvey does, no matter what he says, without being an optimist. You have to be. And this is like two, Shepherd Fairey, you know, Giant Obey, and Mir One, one of the great graffiti artists in Los Angeles, actually came over to me, called me up and said, we want to do, before the 2004 election, we want to do anti-Bush, anti-war posters and take them on tour nationwide. And they said, well, we thought maybe we'd like go get the OG out of the rest home and do a triptych. And OG, which means original gangster to some of us, but in my case, it's old guy. We did this, my printer did it. We made up a thing called Be the Revolution. And that's Shepherd's Hug Babies and Drop Bombs. And Read My Apocalypse, that's me and old Anus Face. And Mirsky did let's play Armageddon, all in spray cans. So we put them up all over the place. You know, Dr. Evil and Mini-Me. I don't know what the hell that is. I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Oh, so this is, you know, anyone here in the entertainment industry? Work for it or anything? Michael Eisner and Katzenberg had a little tiff. Animuscle-mania. You know how... I like Monica. This is her mugshot. And internal affairs is like the English language. Colloquial American English is the most subversive form of communication on the planet. And it's like, if you take internal affairs, everyone knows what that means. If you watch cop shows, police policing themselves, you know how well that works. But in this case, you can find an affair with an intern if you look into that word very carefully. He could find... 52 million dollars of our taxpayers' money. Anybody pay taxes in the 90s? You know, to investigate a blowjob, and who looks most in need of one in this room right now? And speaking of erectile tissue, I did this one for the LA Weekly, and they wouldn't print it. Not because they like Al Gore. Oh, maybe it is. I think they thought it was obscene. That's sad. I don't know. I don't know. You like cats, right, Harvey?
Yeah. You got a couple.
Martha's New Magazine. My wife, Debbie, who's like an impossibly talented movie title designer, actually, and a type whiz, just got into the magazine type a little bit and changed it just a little bit to be more accurate. Oh, see, comics. Maybe, can you read that? Never mind. You know, when W starts talking to the Easter Bunny, you know it can't be good. That was an environmental piece. Give the fucking frog some fucking space. And that's, you know, about Bayona and Playa Vista and 95%, Harvey might not know that 95% of California's wetlands have been destroyed by commercial development, so kill a lot of froggies, birdies, you know, our pals, come on. Any opportunity to make, you know, like psychedelic fucking frogs and putting them up all over the city, gotta do it. You lick it, you get high. It's great. And it's your urban beautification. Oh, that's the back, the wet dream. This baseball season, so... This is a guy, John Rocker, was off his rocker, some, you know, redneck pitcher for the Atlanta Braves who went to New York City and had the misfortune of going to Times Square and said, what are all these brown people doing here? Who let them into the country? We should bring him back and put him on the border, you know, with the Minutemen or something, because he's out of work now. Anyway, I don't know what Eat More Possum means, and something from the redneck white trash cookbook, I don't know. Seemed appropriate, and I didn't even know what that gesture meant until after this was published. I found out really fast. I just thought he looked like an idiot. Oh, that's Harvey. No, I didn't mean anything about idiots. Never mind. So we're back, and Harvey, I do have one more thing.
Go ahead, man.
Okay, so speaking of comics and you know, waving your hands and stuff, we've been putting up posters since 1986, and that's a long time. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool, like we're in LA, special effects and all, wouldn't it be cool to do something animated, like some flash animation? I don't know how to do it, but I know a kid who knows a kid who knows how to do it. He's right over there. And say, hey, kid, you know, make these guys move. And so we did 43 seconds. It took me a year, but we did 43 seconds of primitive, pathetic animation. And took it out with this abomination poster we finally did of Dick Cheney and put it up guerrilla style, went out on Sunset Boulevard, you know, Friday night, 11 o'clock, and shot it on the dome of the Cinerama Dome. Looked great for 11 and a half seconds before the cops came. And on buildings around the city and stuff, just, running this crazy shit, so I thought we'd show it to you. Just
roll it, Robbie.
Yeah, roll it. Somebody.
There it is.
Sad but true. So go get him, Harvey.
You're a tough act to follow, man.
Not for you.
Well, I guess I got to tell you something about my comic books. So when I was a kid, you know, around 8 years old, I read a lot of comics. And then a couple of years later, I got sick of them because they were formulaic. You could predict what was going to happen in them. And I decided that, you know, like a lot of other people have, that comics were a second-rate art form. You know, they just intrinsically were limited. You know, there was some nice stuff that came out in the 50s featuring satire. Mad Comics by Harvey Kurtzman. And that, you know, demonstrated that comics could do more than they had been doing. And this was followed in the 1960s by the alternative comic book movement or the underground comics movement. And I was lucky enough at that time to have met Robert Crumb, who moved into Cleveland about a block away from where I, you know, I lived. And we used to hang out together, and I used to, we would trade records and stuff. It was a pretty good deal for me because I didn't like real old records, and he didn't like, you know, more modern stuff. So when I got the old stuff and he got the modern stuff, we'd swap them and think, what an idiot. I started looking at some of Crumb's stuff, and you know it was brilliant and like nothing I'd seen before, and I decided that I had been wrong about comics, that there was nothing limited about comics. It was just the people who did them that were limited, and the publishers that were, you know, limited or afraid to take a chance or I don't know what. But anyway, comics, you know, seemed to me to be as good an art form as any around. And I followed the underground comic book movement through the 60s and became aware of, you know, a lot of really fine artists. I think that was the best period of alternative comics. Guys like Frank Stack and Spain Rodriguez, you know, wonderful, wonderful artists. And I was, you know, also formulating ideas in my head about what I, what I would do in comics. I mean, since, you know, comics were to me now a wide open field, you know, what would I do, you know, especially given the fact that I couldn't draw, what would I do in the comics field? And I decided that I would like to do autobiographical comics, and in that respect, I was sort of influenced by guys like Henry Miller, and I would like to do things about everyday life, quotidian life, and
what were you
doing at that time, Harvey, when you made that decision? Was it you were working at the VA?
Yeah, I was a file clerk at the VA hospital. I was there for a long time.
When I was a kid, I was a kind of a street corner comedian. I used to make up these routines, and as I was telling them, I would, instead of telling a joke one time to 50 people, I would tell it 50 times to one person. So I like to get a lot of laughs, you know. So some of these routines, when I finally, in 1972, decided I was going to write some comic book stories, using the storyboard form with stick figures and, you know, thought and word balloons. I thought that I would use some of the stories that I had made up, as in my identity as a street corner comic or a class clown or whatever. And so I wrote some of those down and with a few other ones. And Crumb happened to be at my house in 1972. I think that's probably what inspired me to write them. I figured it was now or never because I'd been fooling around and not doing anything and, you know, wasn't getting any younger. So I showed the stories to Crumb, and he said, "These are really good. I'd like to take them home and illustrate them." And I just, that was one of the big breaks of my life because, you know, Crumb was an established great cartoonist, and to just be associated with him was a feather in my cap. You know, Picar worked with Crumb. How bad could he be? You know.
We were talking about, it was like in 76, Robbie, that you first saw Harvey stuff.
That's the first time I saw American Splendor.
Because I was wondering, just in terms of audience then, I mean, so you're starting to write about everyday life. Did you have some idea of like how that, you know, how you hope to affect people with that?
Yeah, what I wanted to do was I wanted them to identify with me, you know, and my situations and predicaments. And I wanted them to, you know, see that even though I was maybe, a lot of people just thought I was a schmuck, that I was, I thought I was important enough to write about. And maybe they were important to write about too.
See, that helped me out. I mean, 1976, at least the beginning of it, was one of the worst years of my life, you know, closely followed by 1971, 72, 73, 70. But I was living in a store, like a used TV store in North Oakland, across the street from a black Muslim bakery, and the neighborhood was so bad or tough that the corner Bank of America fled to Charlotte, North Carolina, and got replaced by Big Daddy's Fried Fish Hut. And when the Muktananda Yoga brought his ashram into the corner and painted the building puce, Big Daddy said to me, "There goes the neighborhood." And so I picked up the comic book and I said, all right, maybe it ain't so bad. Maybe I could do something if he's doing it. And he got Crumb to do it. And a bunch. You had a few artists in that first comic.
Yeah. I scraped up guys from wherever I could.
Because I got scraped up from the streets of North Oakland myself.
I would have scraped you up if I'd have had the chance.
I would have appreciated that. That's what.
But anyway, so at first I was just getting in, a few pieces in anthologies from 72 to about 1975, you know, and the comic scene was getting pretty bad, the alternative comic scene, because
the hippies were fading away, and they, you know, now that they, you know, the Vietnam War was over and the draft was over, you know, they were becoming something other than hippies, and head shops were dying. Hippies used to, you know, be the main purchasers of underground comics, but they weren't around anymore to speak of. And at the same time, I decided that I would, I was getting more and more ambitious about what I wanted to write, the length of the stories and the complexity of the stories. And I thought the only way that I can do this, since publishers aren't taking anything anymore, is put out my own comic with the money I save from, you know, not stopping to collect records. And so that's, you know, that's what I did. And
who were some of the influences on you? I mean, and I open this up to both of you. I mean, you said you mentioned Mad, and I mean, who up until then? I mean, you kind of spring forth as this, you know, as a writer and writing these stories about your life. But did you have models of other autobiographical writing?
Well, mostly outside of comics, I had plenty of models.
Such as?
I had, George Ade was a big influence on me. It's a guy that nobody knows about anything about, but he was one of the best realistic writers around the turn of the 20th century, and, you know, wrote about every everyday life in Chicago. And so, you know, he impressed me. Joyce influenced me. James Joyce. My wife, too.
You said comedian.
Comedians, yeah, stand-up comedians. Have really helped me with my timing. You know, like I used to like to write pauses into the into the comics. The way that they would, you know, they would stop, you know, they would hesitate for a second, and then they would hit you with the next, you know, line, and it had much more impact than if they just rattled it off. And so, you know, and of course, I really loved Lenny Bruce. I thought he was great. I thought Bob and Ray were wonderful, very underrated.
What about you, Robbie? What was going into your stew, Robbie Canal stew?
Pogo. Well, possum stew. Sorry. Walt Kelly. I mean, you know, my parents were communists. My dad brought me Walt Kelly. He said, "Look, there's Joseph McCarthy as a Wolverine." You know. Doing bad shit. I mean, my dad was blacklisted, and the FBI used to walk me to school when I was 8 years old, so I was the safest kid in the neighborhood, as they always told me. Nobody's going to mug you, kid. You got us. But so he gave me Pogo, and I loved that. And the Marx Brothers, you know, Carl and Groucho, I loved them. They were fantastic and wacky, and that all meant something. W.C. Fields, like I just couldn't believe W.C. Fields. Like Harvey would be a good W.C. Fields, you know. Give him a few years, and you know, just like Godfrey Daniel. I just couldn't believe that, because where I come from, you know, look, if you talk as slow as Harvey, nobody understands you. So you talk a little faster, I can't understand you, man. So W.C. Fields, that timing, like he slowed things down. He was almost like the Ray Charles band on Smack, you know, like really wait for it.
I take a lot of pills, man.
Hey,
give me
you
a
go.
Break.
Secrets out. Well, I'll have what he's having.
You know, I was thinking about your folks were. You know, you said your dad was blacklisted, and you were, you know, they were working to free the working man. And here, you know, your work is really based on, you know, the working class guy, and you know, seeing the world and calling it like it is. I mean, what do you think is the plight of the working class today? I mean, what's it like in Cleveland now for?
It's terrible.
Yeah. No.
And it's Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, Detroit. It's there's no work. There's no work for the working class.
They used to call us working class. We just ain't working no more.
If there is work, it's like a Walmart or something like that. You notice that, that while, maybe the country's economic production increases, poverty increases too. So what does that tell you, Somebody's just getting, paid virtually nothing.
There needs to be the Harvey Picard of Walmart instead of the VA, kind of chronicling the inside. Do you know of other people that are, in terms of autobiographical, what are the ones that you admire now, people doing autobiographical work out in the...
Well, I don't know that, there have always been a fair amount of pretty good autobiographical comic book writers. Right now, though, the people that I like a lot are, there's a guy named Chris Ware, Dan Clowes, Joe Sacco. Those are some of the people that I like.
I think The Simpsons is autobiographical.
Is it?
Was, wasn't it?
And what? Tell us about Michael Malice. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I was thinking about you, Robbie. You're doing these celebratory portraits now, like you.
Don't tell anybody that.
Oh, sorry. Well, I saw some of them. They're on your website. You're getting to spend some time with Gandhi and the Dalai Lama instead of Dick Cheney. And here
it's
you
terrifying.
Picked a guy to write a whole book about who's he's not your everyday. He's not your kind of regular kind of hero material. How'd you come across Michael? Tell him a little bit about Michael, because...
All right. A little bit goes a long way. Michael was a guy I met in New York, and he's a Ukrainian Jew, but moved to Brooklyn at the age of a year and a half. And, I gradually, as I got to know... I wrote a story about him right away, about how he was trying to save this tropical fish during the blackout of 1963. And I kept in touch with him, and, there were things about him that, didn't quite add up to me. Like, he was always, bragging about his intellect and putting other people down. And I wondered, is he really, that confident in himself, or is he hiding something? And I really haven't figured it out to this day. But he was a guy that, if you you looked at what he did, and like sort of thought about him in relation to yourself, you would question yourself as well. And so I did a Studster Kell kind of thing with him. I just got a whole lot of material from him and put it in a book and didn't offer any judgments. In fact, I haven't come to any final judgments. I like him okay, even though he likes Ayn Rand. But... so I don't know. I guess I'll just keep on checking him out and seeing what I can come up with.
What's his reaction to the book?
He loves it.
Yeah. A whole book about himself. Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, people would ask me, do people get mad at you when you write about them in my comic, in your comic? And what people would get mad at me was if I didn't write about him in the comic. It was like, hey, man, I'm your friend. Why aren't you writing about me, What's the matter with me, Everybody wants to, get their picture in the paper or even get it in the comic books or be on TV or all this bullshit. So
the other side of that is like the way Harvey works, and I know the way I think is, you know, anybody I know has had a boring job, and I've had a series of really shit jobs. And while you're going through something like that, even like at a party that's like not working out too well, you're thinking in the back of your mind, you know, like say I was worked for Yellow Cab, I couldn't get a job in 71, and after I was playing semi-pro baseball in Canada, that's another story. It also didn't work out too well, since they play baseball with a hockey mentality, like hockey on dirt, man. That's why you get punched out of second base. Never mind. you hippie fag. But, you know, I was driving Yellow Cab in San Francisco, a graveyard, driving with ex-cons, me and ex-cons. That's what a wonderful job it was. All the time I'm trying to live through this, I'm going, this is terrible shit, but it's going to make a good story. And that's all you can do, you know, it's like...
And hope people identify.
Yeah, I mean, we've all been through it. At least you're curious, you know, like, what was a guy like Toxic Bob really like? Not good.
What about the subjects of some of your work? Have you had any comments from the those in Washington who have been the subject of your...
Well, my art, it really isn't for them.
No.
I'm not for them. Well, there's always stories, you know. I mean, we did one of Newt Gingrich called New Twit a long time ago, and put it up all over Washington, D.C., and there was an article in the Washington Post in the Metro section the next day that noted that limos, black limos had been driving around midnight with guys in suits jumping out and taking down posters of Newt Gingrich. And so I guess that means somebody didn't like it. We had to go out and put them up again the next night. You know, and I was actually in 1988 or something. I was on CBS This Morning, and which I'd been up three days and three nights, and went in a T-shirt or something. I said, "You're wearing that?" I said, "Yeah," but I was barely awake. But one of the hosts, I was talking to Harry Smith, and he had no idea who I was, which was really helpful. But another one of the hosts, I can't even remember her name now, I'm just blocking it out, it was so bad, but she was wearing a white Angora suit. It was very fluffy, like a bunny. And she came over to me and she said, "You know, I gave your Men with No Lips poster to Casper Weinberger." I said, "Oh, thank you very much." She said, "He didn't like it." Great. I'd be hurt if he liked it.
I mean, you both are working in terms of outside. You know, that phrase "outsider art" usually means something fairly specific. And
you're not getting paid.
Right. But you both found your own. You know, you made your own delivery system. I mean, you made your comics. You know, you got them out there. You get them out on the, you know, on the road everywhere. We can see them. So
whether you want to or not.
Whether you want to or not. I mean, do you kind of espouse that as a way of, I mean, what, you know, if nothing should stop you, you can get it out there.
Yeah, if all else fails, I mean, you start publishing your own comics, you're almost sure to lose a lot of money. But if you want to get them, you know, out there, that's what I did. I didn't spend much money on myself, just my record collection, so I just shifted that money to comics and worked out okay, you know.
Well, Robbie, I think there's a quote from you in one interview where talking about maybe your, you know, new work, new paintings, where you said, I have a genuine fear of success at a market level.
Did I say that?
What's the matter
with
you, man?
I take it back. No, I guess it's that ambivalence about our culture, you know, getting gobbled up. I mean, remember, my parents were communists. You know, like, isn't that some B-movie or something? You know, like, I married a communist.
Don't
that
you,
was
don't
my
you
mother.
Have that in common, too? I mean, your mom, you were
my
telling.
My mother was a communist, yeah.
And his father was a Talmudic scholar. My grandfather was a Talmudic, I can't even say it. Talmudic scholar
It's a match made in heaven. What can I say?
Yeah, so that's why we're two little Jewish guys, you know, just crabby as hell.
Speaking of Jewish guys, you know the scene in American Splendor? I had to tell this story where, which I love, in which the little old Jewish lady, you know, you stand behind, you pick who you're going to stand behind in line. So a few weeks ago, I was in New York, and I went into this Korean grocery late at night, the all-night grocery, and, you know, bought my little stuff for the week and the little basket, and I get up the counter. There's no one behind me. I always forget how fast things are in New York. So there's no one behind me. Remember, I forgot toilet paper. So he said, back there. I ran to the back of the room, and you had to take one of those, gripper things. Yeah. So I grip it, and all of a sudden, a dozen, toilet papers are falling down on my head, hitting me on the head. I'm trying to pick them up, and I pick one, and I run back up. And, of course, now there's, 10 people in line, and they're all really pissed off at me, and he hasn't been able to, close the cash register. And I realize I've become that little old lady in the Harvey P. I'm the lady in American Splendor that you don't want to get behind in the grocery store.
If it's in you, it'll come out.
And this is the section of the program where we get picaresque.
Yes, yes.
Everybody tells their picaresque story.
Well, I think would you guys, before we open it up to questions, is there anything else you would like to ask each other?
How about putting me in one of your comics? I'll draw it.
Yeah, I just wrote about doing some stuff in Chicago promoting a comic. Why not here?
You just finished a new story,
yeah. Yeah, I just finished a new story,
Today in the hotel, right?
Yeah, in the hotel.
That's what L.A. is good for, sitting in a hotel, finish a story. Yeah. That's true.
We couldn't drag him out.
This place they put me at doesn't even have a clock.
I know, he was really disturbed by that. But Harvey, you can call downstairs, you needn't worry.
I don't know, I just think...
Will Harvey see that clock? Sometimes that clock has been known to run backwards at the library. We call it the Salvador Dali effect. It's very worrisome.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, how about... we have a microphone in the room, and you guys feel free to jump in with questions anytime that you might have for each other. You can override. We'll start over there.
Something to say.
Robbie, I remember seeing... so many posters around town of yours. And I wondered how many went up and how did you finance them? It costs money to print posters and it takes people
really?
To put them up. Well, I assumed so.
Yeah, that's a good question. Before I got married, I used to come out of my own pocket and that stopped. Yeah, it comes out of my wife's pocket because somebody has to have a job. And I really thousands and thousands and thousands of posters. And I mean, the hardest thing, I didn't know anything about making posters. I just knew that, I was angry as hell about certain public issues. And found myself making these little nasty little black and white paintings of ugly old white men in suits and ties who had way too much power over us and were abusing it. And that's a public issue. So not that any gallery is going to want to put up one of these things and try to sell it, like a nasty little portrait of Ronald Reagan. Like, anybody want to put that in the living room? Maybe if as a diet aid, trying to lose weight, and you look up and you go, oh, I'm not hungry, I'm nauseous. But also, it's about public issues, and I have feelings about it that I want to express in public, so maybe the friendly confines of the art establishment wasn't really going to do it for getting it out to people who come to libraries, not to art galleries. So I had to make my escape and figure it out somehow. And those posters were pathetic. In terms of design, everything I do in terms of design, until I got Debbie to do it, looked terrible. I only knew Helvetica Bold, and I didn't even know that its name. I just knew you could read it on the street, And it was sad, but it's a total lost production. I just always thought of it as like my art materials, like brushes and paint. only a little more expensive.
And you, you had a vast volunteer army of putting of guerrilla posters. Is this true?
Kind of happened, yeah. It's not like it was a plan. It's like everything I do. I don't know how Harvey does it, but I put one foot in my mouth at a time, one after the other. That's how it works. I didn't have a plan or anything. I just said, I don't know how to do it, but I just went and didn't do it very well, but I just went and did it. And the thing I did know was, like, we're in L.A., everybody in the world thinks we're superficial, and, you know, maybe they're not wrong about that, but what they don't know is we're deeply superficial. And that, to me, that translates into, you know, if you put something up on the surfaces around L.A. enough, people care about it enough to go, what the hell is that? That shouldn't be there. And that's all I ask.
And now it feels like they should be there.
And now people say, what have you done for us lately?
Another question? Do you have another question?
This question is for Harvey, and if it's too personal, don't answer it. When I first met you, we were working in a studio together, and you brought Danielle in with her little horses and her dolls. And I'm wondering how Danielle's doing and what Joyce is up to. Is Joyce still working with young people?
Well, Danielle became 18. She never got past the 10th grade. And, you know, I mean, she's been handicapped by ADD, and the more she went to school, the worse it got. And when she became 18, she decided, you know, that she was going to move back with her mother. So she moved back, you know, with her, and right now she's working on her GED. And there's this guy in Holland that I guess she met on the internet that she's real close to. Joyce was working with young people?
She was pitching me with some stuff she was doing overseas.
Oh, yeah, that was a long time ago. She's not really doing too much now that way. She's in the Unitarian Universalist Society, and she's trying to make it a better world with their help. That's about all I could say.
Other question? Surely, there.
Forced me to tell you another picaresque story.
This is a question for Harvey, which is, you talked about becoming an artist, and all your influences were writers, and you couldn't draw. So why comic books? Why didn't you just write books?
Okay, that's kind of complicated. For one thing, I was ambitious. I wanted to go down in history. Now, if you're an innovator, like, you know, in many, many fields, you got a better shot at, you know, being highly regarded than, you know, if you're just doing the same stuff everybody else is doing. I saw where comics, you know, had such tremendous potential and nobody was using them. And, you know, I thought, you know, well, I know some stuff that I can do if I could just get somebody to, you know, illustrate my story. So, you know, I'm going to take a shot at it. So that's one reason that I did it. Another reason is I like the form. I like to set up, you know, dialogues and conversations, you know, with the, you know, panels and stuff. And I like the way you can time things that way. So there's a couple of reasons.
He's a physical comedian. That's what it is.
Hi. I have a question also for Harvey. How are the Cleveland Indians really doing?
I guess they're probably under 500. I don't know, around 500. They're not doing too hot. I don't know. People just lost interest in it. A lot of the teams, they haven't won a major league championship in any area since 1964, which I think is longer than any other city. So, you know, it's just, you figure if it's from Cleveland, it doesn't work.
The Chamber of Commerce of Cleveland sent Harvey here. That's how bad it is. No, I wanted to say something, though, about innovation, and you know, Harvey's right about that, and I think comics, another thing about comics is it reaches an audience that's a little different from just straight prose. You know, all those, like Frank Zappa said, you know, people say, who's your audience? And he said, you know, that one kid in Thud, Kansas in his basement listening to stuff who thinks he's the only person like that in the world, that's my guy. And, you know, that's a comic book reader. But when I started doing street posters, I thought, oh, this is going to be so cool. You know, I'm going to put up my stuff and you know, fuck them all. So what if it's illegal? I'm just going to go do it, and people are going to see it. And you know, like Chuckles is going to say, oh, I don't agree with that. I'll put up my poster, and we'll have poster wars, you know. Like, of course, didn't happen. I said, how come? You know, like, why isn't anybody? And I realized that after you go out once and it's a lot of fun, second, third, 100th time, you have to be a maniac to go out and keep doing it. Hmm. And so poster wars didn't happen. But after the 2000 election, club culture, the kids, hip-hop kids, skateboard kids, and then the 2004 election, that underground culture got politicized by that, and there is more graffiti and street postering and stenciling going on all around, in every major city in the country now than I've ever seen before, and I've been doing this since 1986, so yes! Not that getting us anywhere, but it will! It will.
Question over there.
This question is for Harvey also. I was wondering, when you started American Splendor, I guess in the mid-70s, did you go around to comic book stores and just place it yourself? Did you just travel around? And were you ever discouraged? You know, how many years did it take before you were successful, that you realized you were going to be successful?
Well, it took until, well, if you're like, you know, screwy like I am, you never think you're going to get successful. You're always waiting for the other shoe to drop. As far as the how I distributed the comics, at that time, there used to be underground comic book distributors. And, you know, since I worked with Crumb, it gave me legitimacy. And I could send my stuff to them, and they would send it out, you know, to stores. But now comics aren't set up like that, and guys who print their own stuff have a much harder time getting it, you know, distributed, because there's like a monopoly in comic distribution. The company named Diamond in Baltimore pretty much rules the roost there. And they don't like to mess around with alternative stuff because there's, you know, not much profit in it. So I guess that I have to bring you up to date there.
But there is a whole other movement of comics on the web. And I was up in Portland for 5 rainy days chasing down these guys from Mercury Studios for a friend. You know, Batman and Superman and Catwoman all live in Portland and Stumptown for some reason. They're hiding. But I met a lot of people there who had full-on comics that they updated every week, every month, and had them on their websites and, you know, had a huge underground audience that way. I don't know if any of you have tried that or have checked it out, but it's pretty much thriving in its way.
And Harvey, have you ever, I mean, I was thinking about the upcoming election and how your either of your work might get out there in the public. Have you ever done cartoons like that are in daily newspapers? I mean, like as editorial cartoons?
I did a couple of things for the New York Times, but they weren't about politics. Hmm. I did do one political thing for the Washington Post.
As we were talking earlier about, you know, what fuels the work and you know, rage has been, you know, your anger at you know, what's going on has, you know, often is like can get you up and out and like to do something. And I don't know if you felt like, you know, that's ever played a role in kind of fueling your work. I mean, your own outrage.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, how could you live in these times and not be furious? As I was telling you guys before we came in here, it might just be too late now anyway. With all the, you know, greenhouse gases in the air, I don't think, you know, like if you get a car that gets a couple of, you know, more miles per gallon, that's going to save the world.
But Debbie already had her solution. We're just going to wipe the slate clean and start all over again. No, I mean,
well,
it's hard to keep the spirit up, you know, but you have to.
Any vegetable oil people out there got something, anything to say about this? Huh? Any soy nuts out there?
Got a question out there? Okay.
I love your work, Robbie Cannell. Love
it. Thank you. I love you.
Love your politics. This is for Harvey Pekar. I saw the movie. Sorry. I don't know.
Fell right into that.
Well, I just had to say my little tribute. But I saw American Splendor, and I'm sure you've relived this a lot. But my memory isn't so great, but I remember that they replayed the scene where you were on Letterman. I guess you went on several times, and finally you spoke the truth on TV, and it was live. And you so rarely see something on TV that seems real. Can you sort of tell us again about that, considering you're just talking about greenhouse gases? Weren't you talking about General Electric?
Yeah, I was talking about General Electric.
Could you tell us about that?
Okay, but you'll see that I'm much more of an opportunist now than an idealist. What happened was I was going on David Letterman's show, I'd been recommended by his head writer who lived in Cleveland. So I was going on the show, and I was doing, like, you know, a self-parody of the Cleveland working man. That's what Letterman wanted me to do. I was a D's and dozers kind of guy. And I got sick of doing that. I wanted to move on to something else. I like comedy, but I don't want to, you know, be doing a self-parody every week. And he wasn't paying, you know, I was getting, you know, the lowest, you know, pay that the union would allow. And my books weren't selling on his show. I mean, as a result of my being on his show. So I figured there's no point, really, in my being on this show. And, you know, I thought, you know, the hell with this. I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory. And so, you know, I mean, I had just read, around that time, GE bought NBC, and, you know, I went and researched GE, and I saw where they had, back in the 20s, they were committing, you know, tons of corporate crimes, and they never let up. And where they were convicted. And I thought it was insane for a corporation like that that made, you know, like parts for atomic weapons, among other things, to have control of NBC News. They could slant it how they wanted to. So I told Letterman, I said, I'm going to talk about this, Letterman. And, you know, if you, you know, like I'll give you some leads into it. And, you know, you can either, you know, you can follow me Or, in, you know, in the second half of my segment, I'm just going to stand up and start preaching. So
you told him this before you went on?
Yeah.
Okay, so he had fair warning.
Yeah, yeah. And they tried to, like, sucker me by having the one of the producers come down and saying, see, Harvey, we're going to have it, you know. And so he'd give me this list of 10 subjects we were going to talk about. And, you know, GE was 7. And we only would cover, like, 3 or 4, you know, in the time my segment went. So I knew they were just trying to bullshit me that they'd never get to number 7. So I just, you know, after the break, when Letterman hadn't done anything, I just went out, I just got up and got on my soapbox and started laying into GE. So that's...
Was that the
no,
end
he
your...
didn't kick me off. No, he didn't kick me off. That was the 4th time I was on. The 5th time I was on, I was like real quiet and uncommunicative, you know, sort of throw him off. The 6th time I was on, I said, I told him, I said, David, just tell me something. How come... You know, you try to stop me from talking about GE, because when you did that, you looked like a shill for GE. And he just got real mad, and, you know. And after my segment, he said to me, you just fucked up a great thing. That might have been great for him, but not for me. And now, you see, I'm a big folk hero, you know.
Another couple questions? Okay. We have one over here, Toby, down here after that one.
Hey, this is actually a question for Robbie.
Shocking.
I don't know. I'm sorry. We don't allow any questions for Robbie.
Okay. Well, then I'll just have to.
No. It's okay.
Now, where can I get copies of your posters?
What a great question.
That's an excellent question. Are you a shill for Robbie?
Hey. He's going to get. His salary is going up.
Toby Dan.
They're all on my web. Yeah, you get one free for that. They're all on my website, robbiecanal.com, if you can spell it. That's the stupid thing. Like, I have this unspellable, unpronounceable name, and I just went, oh, okay, that's me. Instead of like, Art Attack! Or, you know, Harvey! Robbiecanal.com. They're all on there, kind of. Anyone in particular you want?
I've seen a few around town. But really
good. Women with teeth.
And also there's this wonderful sticker that's the waiting, watching, dreaming. Is that right? Am I having the right order?
Watching, waiting, dreaming. What's the difference?
Yeah, what's the difference? But it's Gandhi, the Dalai Lama, and Martin Luther King. I actually gave it as gifts to people going to India, and they gave it to people in India. They loved it.
Oh, good.
No, it's a great thing to give people in other parts of the world.
Indians chasing you. Women with teeth is very popular with dentists. You wouldn't happen to be a dentist.
No.
Yes, over here.
And not everybody gets a picture of Jean Kirkpatrick smiling. I'm the only person who's known to have done one.
Yes.
Robbie, I'll ask you this question now. I've never asked you this question, so
uh-oh.
I know. So you've bucked convention and made your art available intrusively by exhibiting it intrusively outside, but it's fine art, and I have a Robbie piece, and it's
super fine.
Super fine art. And do you expect people to react to it differently than if it was in a gallery? Are you hoping that it moves people from maybe apathy to action, or unlike conventional art?
Well, it's designed differently. You know, it's designed to be seen on the street, and it's designed for traffic light switching boxes, those virulent spawn of HAL, the computer in 2001. You know, on every corner in LA, you have this box that's doing nothing, but you know it's doing something. But our conspiracy theory guy probably thinks it's part of the 9/11 plot. But yeah, they're like one-liners, you know, like they're not designed to change anybody's mind. They're designed to express, you know, my feelings about things that I think are important, like bang, and if you don't get it, there's another one at the next red light, you know, and if the red light doesn't stop you, there's another one at the next one where the cop is. And so if I get them around enough, you know, like even if you just don't know exactly who that guy is or what's up with that bunny, you know, shitting on Dick Cheney's head, you got a few chances to figure it out or think about it. And that's all I ask is just let's think about these guys who are, you know, fucking up the world and maybe we can laugh them out of office or something. But I don't really expect, you know, to change this woman's mind in the front row who's writing down stuff for the FBI. I just try want to express myself in public. Hey, 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 and with like a little joke, maybe. A joke.
This will be our last question.
I have a question for Harvey. I've noticed almost all of your comics, or at least the ones I've read, they always portray you as the adult Harvey. I mean, kind of your life at the time. And I'm wondering, have you ever written any comics about your childhood?
I did a so-called graphic novel called The Quitter, which was published in October, and where I try to take a good look at my childhood. The guy who hit me to the, you know, the guy who made the movie, you know, the American Splendor movie, well, I called him up and I said, man, I realize I owe you. He was an artist, you know, an illustrator who'd done some work for me. And I said, I really owe you, you know, and what within reason can I do to repay you? And he said, I want you to, you know, let me illustrate a long work of yours. So what, you know, I thought, what kind of long work can I write? And it came to mind that I hadn't dealt that much, you know, with my youth, you know, that I, you know, I could do something, in, you know, about it there, thus satisfying him. And, you know, it wound up being a nice project for myself, too, for me.
That'd be a good comic book to have Robbie's childhood, too.
I don't think so.
I don't know. The son of communist
the
art
spitter.
Brat.
Spitting consciousness. I mean,
well, I think...
I want to say one thing, because Colette brought it up. I mean, that whole thing about fine art versus street art or fine art versus comics, I do come from fine art. I went to art school all my life, and you know, the Bush administration has inspired me so much that I'm actually going to... I did a series of dancing skeletons of the Bush administration, you know, Darth Condi and, you know, skull-juggling Rummy, and they're all skeletons, they're all dancing. I'm going to do a Dance of Death show in an actual art gallery of the original drawings, opening October 26th at Track 16 Gallery in Bergamot Station. Have a big party. You're all invited. Dance of Death. Something uplifting that Harvey's invited to. And for, you know, Halloween, Dias de los Muertos, the midterm elections, and the World Series.
That's good. Let's all turn out and
all come down.
I think we're lucky to have both these folk heroes here. Thank you all so much, and they'll both be signing books in the lobby. What?
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.